Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 339. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois, and we're delighted to be back with you for another program. It's just me today in terms of the regulars, but we have a very special episode lined up for you. Today, we welcome to the program Brian Winter, who is an attorney who practices law in and around Lake County, Illinois. He's also a deacon at Hope OPC in Grays Lake, where I serve as pastor. Welcome to the program, Brian. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Camden.
Brian has written an excellent paper. It's as yet unpublished, but we hope to change that down the road, on a Dutch secessionist minister named Peter Zona, who founded somewhat of a community and a church in Wisconsin. So we're going to talk about all the peculiarities of this history, because it's rather unusual for Dutch immigrants to start Presbyterian churches, especially in the mid-19th century, but we're going to be talking about that today and unpacking a little bit of Midwestern Reformed history. But before we do so, I do have a few things to mention. First, that Christ the Center, of course, is listener-supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners to help keep us going. We encourage you to visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate. But we also want to mention that the Reformed Forum Theology Conference is going to happen, we hope, October 10th through 12th, 2014. It will be held in Grays Lake, Illinois, which is just a little bit north of O'Hare Airport outside of Chicago. As you listen today, if you're listening right on time, you have about 3 days left to pledge your support for this program, for this conference. We're doing a crowdfunding campaign, and as I just checked right before recording, we're at 90% funded, but we need your help. If you'd like to come to this conference, if you want to make it a reality, then help us meet our goal. We're just under $1,000 left to get there, but if we don't reach our goal by Sunday, June 29th, the conference is going to be a no-go, and we'd miss out having you, as well as having everyone else who's already registered, and their pledges will be returned. But we don't want that to happen. We want to see you October 10th through 12th in Grays Lake, Illinois, for our first Reformed Forum Conference. We hope to have Dr. Scott Oliphant and Dr. Lane Tipton to come speak about the Sons of God. So make that happen. Reformedforum.org. Visit us today. We want to thank you so much for your support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Now, Brian, I should mention, as we open up this wonderful paper, as yet unpublished, but one, again, like I said, we hope to expose to more and more people, we're looking at a history here that is really lurking in the background for a lot of us in northern Illinois and southern Wisconsin, but it's also a history that at least the Presbyterians might not know. We might not understand how influential some of these immigrants were. But before we get into the actual details of the history and details of the guys involved and the reasons why they did what they did, how were you introduced to the subject in general, and how did you come to actually research this history, seeing that you practice law, you are an officer in the church, but what led you to do this work in theological history?
Well, actually, that's a pretty simple question to answer, because I had a paternal grandfather that immigrated from the Netherlands, and so I grew up essentially in a Reformed church. And as I was growing up, part of the curriculum of Sunday school was to learn church history. And then at some point, I was reading a publication that talked about Dutch Presbyterians.
Yeah.
And I had never crossed that type of reference.
Those words together.
Correct. And so eventually, I took it upon myself to learn more about him. And that's really the genesis behind the paper that I've written.
Wow. So we have here a figure that we're going to study mostly, a guy named Peter Zona. That's a Z-O-N-N-E, if I'm getting that correctly. He was the first secessionist minister to immigrate to Wisconsin. And once he was there, he eventually led his church of Dutch immigrants into the Presbyterian denomination, as we mentioned, which is already a unique thing. Because at this time, it was more and more or less common for them to join a Reformed Protestant Dutch church, which we would say today would be the RCA, a denomination that many of our listeners will be familiar with. Could you describe for us a little bit about the Dutch secessionist movement? What led Zona to leave Netherlands in the first place, and what was going on historically at the time? And where are we, generally speaking, in terms of the timeline?
Basically, the secessionist movement was a protest movement within the State Reformed Church, and it began in 1834 when several Dutch ministers became concerned about the doctrine and polity of the state church. Mm-hmm. And their discussions really led to a pretty stern rebuke by the state church. Many of these ministers were either suspended or deposed. And after they were deposed, they began to form their own congregations, meeting in homes, and continuing their ministry. At this point in time, this group acquires the name the Afscheiding, a Dutch word meaning separation or secession movement, and it really continues for about a period of 12 years where these ministers are no longer part of a denomination, but they are now working independently to create a new church, which they believe will restore orthodoxy to the Reformed faith.
Now, in your paper, you do mention several significant figures that eventually emigrated to the United States, and these include Albertus van Ralte. He ended up in Holland, Michigan, as well as Hendrik Scholte, who ended up in Pella, Iowa. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then you have Peter Zona. He's the interesting figure we want to focus on that ended up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Tell us about Peter Zona and what is his history that eventually leads him to where we find him in the United States.
Basically, Zona was raised in the Reformed Church, and at the age of 21, he moved to Delft, where he started his own sail-making business with the help of his father, who himself was a merchant. He shortly thereafter became married, and basically, a couple years after the secessionist movement began in 1836, he himself joined the secessionist movement. At first, there was no church or secessionist congregation in Delft, so he participated with a congregation in a neighboring town. But by 1840, he was one of the organizers of a secessionist congregation in Delft. Once the Delft congregation was up and running, he then really began considering changing careers, and in 1841 began ministerial training under Reverend Anthony Brummelkamp, another very famous secessionist minister. He completed that study in 1842, and shortly thereafter, he received his first call from a secessionist church, one in the town of Henderen, which is actually located in an island off of the Rhine River in North Brabant. As far as his ministry, the reports are that he was successful in his ministry. However, during this time period, there was a lot of conflict that would emerge in different secessionist congregations. And in 1846, that happened to Zona in his own church. Basically, he became embroiled in a difference in opinion regarding operating the church. Apparently, some of his sermons were a little direct in their instruction, and at least one elder reported him to other secessionist ministers for purposes of discipline. And at that time, since there was really no official organization for the secessionist movement, panels of neighboring secessionist ministers would be called to hear disputes within the church. In Zona's case, a panel was initially convened, and they sided with Zona. However, shortly thereafter, the same dispute was brought up again, and at that point, he actually was suspended from the ministry as far as those three ministers were concerned.
Right. And so this is really kind of a church denomination in transition. It's being formed, but the way the panel worked, they suspended him from ministry at this time. What did he do?
Well, basically, there aren't any direct records concerning mm-hmm. that, but the
not
records,
just here, but not in Netherlands either.
Not particularly, but yeah. there is some description of the process itself that mm-hmm. these panels were convened, and just for point of reference, this happened to several secessionist ministers, including Sculta himself. He at one point was suspended by a panel of secessionist ministers as well, concerning disputes about possible church order.
Mm. Now, even though he was suspended, he did go on to preach at other area churches. You do mention that while he was preaching in Postwick or Postvik, how do you pronounce
well,
it?
Well, basically after the suspension, just like Sculta,
yeah.
He continued to preach, and congregations continued to call him to fill their pulpit. And eventually, he winds up at a state called Postvik, and it's outside of the town of Upcouda, in the province of Utrecht. And this particular estate was owned by a widow who was a patron of the secessionist movement. And the description of his ministry there is that many people came to listen to his sermons. And eventually, for Zona, this attracted the attention of the government. And he was fined, something that Zona appealed. In fact, with the help of Judith Zalf, the owner of the estate, he actually tried to appeal it to the King of the Netherlands to no avail. In addition to that, he wrote a pamphlet for publication discussing the persecution that was taking place against secessionist ministers. So, again, that's really reflective of one of the reasons that secessionist ministers ultimately decided to explore the possibility of emigrating to America.
And that's why he eventually left and arrived in Milwaukee in July 1847. He began preaching on Dutch Hill. Interesting. But once he arrived there, other than preaching on Dutch Hill, what did he do? And what was the status of Milwaukee at the time? And this is 1847, quite early on. Well, is this a bustling metropolis or a farm town? How would you describe Milwaukee?
Well, in 1847, Milwaukee has approximately 6,000 people living in at this point what is still referred to as the Wisconsin Territory. The next year, it will become a state.
So Illinois, for comparison, became a state in 1818.
Correct.
Right? But Wisconsin had been settled and was owned by the U.S., but the territory of, but not an official state.
Correct. Okay. And actually, that's one of the reasons that Wisconsin became an attractive site for immigrants, because it had been a territory, the land had now been surveyed, and the government was going to sell land.
Homesteads?
Homesteads,
something like that.
Yeah, absolutely, homesteads, and the prices for the land would be very reasonable. So actually, Wisconsin was the hotbed for immigration in 1847 and continuing on for a relatively short period, because the demand for the land was so great, and this was really the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to buy land in Wisconsin.
Hmm. Now, how did Zona become involved in civic life? I mean, he was doing a lot more than just religious and ministerial duties. What were some things he became involved in, and how did he find himself in that position?
Well, it might be appropriate to compare his involvement to that of the other two famous secessionist ministers. In 1846, Van Ralte, or Van Ralte as the Dutch would pronounce the name, made the decision to immigrate. However, the immigration of Van Ralta's group that he led was much different than the group, circumstances under which Zona came to America. What is significant about Dutch immigration in the mid-1800s is the fact that secessionist ministers really took it upon themselves to create immigration societies. They knew that people in the Netherlands were interested in immigrating. The Dutch secessionist ministers were interested because of the persecution from government, as were their members of their churches. But there also were economic reasons for immigration. That was another push factor. And the secessionist ministers wanted to make the journey an organized affair and one that they could direct the immigrants to communities that they would set up in America that would keep the immigrants together. Van Ralta, in particular, was very interested in creating a Dutch colony. And that is really one of the reasons why he chose Michigan as opposed to coming to Wisconsin or Iowa. Basically, Wisconsin had been a state for some time period, and there really was not any new lands to be offered. But Western Michigan was an area that primarily was an area of trees and woods, and probably not the best soil. So it had actually been overlooked by both Yankee immigrants from the East Coast looking for land out west, and for that matter, immigrants. So when Van Ralta decided on developing Western Michigan or Holland, Michigan for his Dutch colony, that was somewhat unexpected. Because there had been some preliminary discussions that they would go to Wisconsin or to some of the new lands that were made available at this time.
So there are a lot of economic factors here involved in immigrating and moving from one place to the other, and reasons why you might choose Wisconsin over Michigan, or I imagine you could throw Iowa in there. What was the role of religion in the immigration movement from the Netherlands?
It really provided the leadership for the immigrants. Van Ralta, in particular, had the Arnhem Immigration Society. Skulte had the Utrecht Immigration Society. And there was also an immigration society out of the province of Zeeland that was led by another secessionist minister. These immigration societies and these secessionist ministers were very significant, because once these groups were organized, the leaders of these groups really made the ultimate decision as to where the immigrants would ultimately settle.
Did they have any involvement in terms of in managing the transfer of land and stuff? I believe, as we've talked before, Zona was somehow involved in real estate as well. Was that the case in many of these immigrant communities?
Absolutely. To a greater extent, Van Ralta was involved in land management matters. Skulte was definitely involved in purchasing land, deciding on Pella, Iowa as the location for the immigration society that he led. Probably less so for Zona, because when he immigrated to America, because he was coming from the post-Vica state, where he had been preaching, those people, by and large, were well-to-do and were not necessarily interested in immigration. The people that accompanied Van Ralta, much of that was rural-to-rural immigration, people that did not have land in the Netherlands but were interested in farming in America, and likewise for the Pella, Iowa settlement. So Zona essentially signed on with a ship that was leaving the Netherlands for America, but he did not have a particular congregation or a group in tow. And so I think that's actually one of the reasons why the Zona settlement, which we'll later talk about, occurs in Cedar Grove, Wisconsin, north of Milwaukee, is not as large a settlement as the Western Michigan settlements or the Pella, Iowa settlement.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. What was the church polity for these new immigrant congregations? Zona, he gets on the ship. He eventually, from various circumstances, becomes kind of the leader, the religious leader of this organization that eventually settles later on. But what was the church polity for the other groups? And, you know, what type of influences were also affecting Zona's crew?
Well, that's actually something that was discussed in the bylaws or constitutions of the immigration societies. Mm-hmm. In the case of the immigrants that went to Western Michigan, they knew that Van Ralta would be a religious leader for the colony.
That's what they were signing up for.
They were signing up for that. Sculta took a different approach. Basically, the constitution for the Utrecht Society was that we will establish a Christian community, but leave it up to its membership. And what later occurred was Sculta never did join a formal denomination. He always led an independent church, with which, if you look at the bylaws for the Immigration Society, maybe that was predictable and that was something that was on his mind. But there was no such immigration society or bylaws that would lead the group, the groups that would come to Wisconsin. And so essentially, when Zona arrives in Milwaukee, there's approximately 6,000 people living in the city. There are already Dutch immigrants there, several hundred. They have set up camp on what becomes known as Dutch Hill. And in fact, he becomes the first Protestant Dutch secessionist minister to come to the Wisconsin territories. Hmm. And he does immediately begin to lead the immigrants on Dutch Hill in religious worship. Hmm. It is an independent church at that point in time. And basically, he stays in Milwaukee for really just a matter of months. After he arrives in Milwaukee, became famous disaster occurs with involving one of the lake steamers that are bringing immigrants to Wisconsin, a ship called the Phoenix. And basically, the ship burns at sea. 151 Dutch immigrants perish. And when this occurs, Zona is now in Milwaukee and basically is placed on a committee formed by the city government to investigate not only how the disaster occurred, but also how the people of Milwaukee and the churches in Milwaukee can respond to the needs of the survivors. And it's really at this point that Zona is probably first introduced to ministers of the Presbyterian Church in Wisconsin.
So just roughly about 6 months later, then they organize that Dutch settlement in Cedar Grove, just 6 months roughly after the Phoenix burns down.
Correct, because, and, I mean, basically, the Dutch that are in Milwaukee, even though they haven't signed on to an immigration society, they are looking for farmland.
And for people that might not know the Midwestern geography, how far is Cedar Grove from Milwaukee?
It's approximately 50 miles to the north.
Yeah. So then in September of 1848, Zona organizes this independent Reformed church, and it's at that time that they actually build a building in which they'll meet, right?
Right. So in the early months of 1848, Zona goes up with some of the other, goes north with the other, with a group of Dutch immigrants, and they basically survey the property up in the county of Sheboygan, the southeast corner, and they decide that looks like it's a suitable place to start a settlement. The farmland looks good, or the land looks as if it can be converted into farmland. And he is involved in many of the land transactions. One of the reasons for that is Zona learns English rather quickly.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And so he is able to help other settlers that have just come off the boat move up to Cedar Grove.
And so that also puts him by default in an interesting civic position, because he's able to negotiate between people speaking in Dutch and, you know, English settlers and other Americans. And does that end up reinforcing his position as a leader, you think?
Certainly, initially it does. And okay. Remember, and we talked about it earlier, uh-huh. Zona had been a businessman.
Yeah.
At a very young age. And so he was familiar with business transactions. Hmm. So undoubtedly, he was able to provide assistance in informing the settlement, which later became known as Cedar Grove, mm-hmm. A name that Zona is given credit for naming the town where these settlers ultimately bought land.
Mm. Now, Zona's working here, and they have an independent Reformed church. It goes on for a couple of years. Now, if we look across Lake Michigan over into western Michigan, Van Ralta at the time has organized Classis Holland. Is that right?
Correct.
And that's in 1848, but then the entire Classis moves into the RCA in 1850. Is that an attractive option for Zona? How does he look at the RCA, and if not, why not?
Well, the fact that Classis Holland has been formed is something that members of his church are aware of, mm-hmm. Because basically, at this point in time, there are letters going back and forth from immigrants that are located in America back to Holland to explain the circumstances, to encourage other immigrants to join them. And there are also newspaper accounts and letters going between members of the different settlements. So people in Wisconsin are aware that the largest Dutch settlement, that of Van Ralta's group in western Michigan, have joined the RCA. Again, I think we mentioned early on, at the time, the Reformed Church of America was known as the Reformed Protestant Dutch Church. And essentially, you have Zona in Cedar Grove, one minister, one independent church. In western Michigan, you have seven congregations, four ministers led by Van Ralta, and in 1850, essentially at his meetings with Classis Holland, he is authorized to investigate joining the RCA. And in fact, there was some discussion as to whether the individual congregations had to join the RCA, or what became known as the RCA. Ultimately, it was decided the whole Classis could join the Reformed Protestant Dutch Church in mass. Okay. And so that occurs in 1850.
Wow. But Zona does not, or his church, I should say, the independent church in Cedar Grove, Wisconsin, does not do a similar thing.
No, he doesn't. And however, that becomes a point of contention, because undoubtedly after that occurs, members of his congregation are wondering what direction is his church going to take. And basically, as we discussed, Zona was familiar with Presbyterian ministers by this time. As far as the RCA's presence in Wisconsin, there really was none. At this time in history, the Presbyterian Church was the largest Reformed denomination, and in fact was much more active both in the Wisconsin Territory and now the state of Wisconsin in forming and organizing churches in this new state. Essentially, there was no RCA minister in the state of Wisconsin when Zona arrived in Milwaukee.
And plus, he speaks English well. He's had good business relationships with other people in the in his area, and so he also has the facility or the ability to work with other people that are already in Wisconsin. So,
well,
he has a little bit more flexibility too, doesn't he?
Well, that's true, and I think really an important part of his ultimate decision. Mm-hmm. And we know he's going to affiliate with the Presbyterian Church, is he realizes Wisconsin is not Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Michigan is attracting basically half of the immigrants coming to America. The rest are either going to Iowa, probably the second most popular destination, and then the balance is being split up between different communities in New York, Illinois, and Wisconsin. So I think early on, Zona realizes that he is not going to have the ability to form a Dutch colony like Van Ralta has mm-hmm. done in Western Michigan, not because of a necessarily lack of leadership, just because there are not enough immigrants to have more than one Western Michigan settlement.
Does Zona's personal history with Van Ralta influence his decision to eventually join the Presbyterians?
Well, it may. Mm-hmm. To the extent that Zona certainly experienced the secessionist troubles, really, in organizing mm-hmm. Congregations, and later that period in secessionist history in the Netherlands was referred to as the crisis of youth. Because they're struggling to formulate a church order and to organize. I think Zona was cautious, certainly, as to what particular denomination he wanted to identify with.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding that by joining a denomination, you would take on the polity of that church. And quite frankly, Zona, because he was in Wisconsin, would not have had really any exposure to the denomination at that time known as the Reformed Protestant Dutch Church, because there were no churches from that denomination in mm-hmm. Wisconsin.
Unless he made a trip around the lake once in a while, but that would be almost, well, not impossible, but it would be an arduous task.
It's not something that he did.
Yeah, right. That eventually caused some strife in his congregation, though, correct? Because they were worried about not being connected with Dutch immigrants any longer. They were worried, some of them at least, not all of them, but some of them were worried that affiliating as Presbyterians would remove them from their countrymen or their former, their heritage.
Right? Absolutely. What really happened after 1850, when Van Ralta affiliated with the Reformed Protestant Dutch Church, the next step for Van Ralta was to look at the other settlements to see whether this Dutch denomination could expand to the other settlements. So in addition to joining the RCA in 1850, for the first time, one of the ministers from Western Michigan makes the trip across the lake over to Oostburg, just north of Cedar Grove, Wisconsin, and attempts to begin a RCA congregation. So almost immediately, the Dutch immigrants are aware that a lot of the Dutch are joining the RCA, and that probably is putting pressure on Zona to make a decision in terms of affiliation. Should he stay in an independent Reformed church, or should he affiliate with a denomination? And ultimately, in 1853, he does make that decision, and he decides to affiliate with the Presbyterians.
Mm-hmm. How did that work out for Zona? There's a lot more history we could get into that is going to be available in Brian's paper. We don't need to get into all the details, but just from 30,000 feet, did they remain Presbyterians, and did Zona go on to minister for the rest of his life, or how did he end up?
Well, Zona did continue on ministering in Cedar Grove in the church that he organized. But immediately after making the decision to affiliate with the Presbyterian denomination, and this happened to be the New School a branch of the Presbyterian Church, there was a split in his own congregation for the reason that you described, that a lot of the Dutch immigrants were concerned that they would not have relationships with other Dutch immigrants. And so immediately the church split, and it was a challenging time for Zona. Resulted in a period of time where Zona was so concerned with what was going on and being said about his decision that for a couple months in 1854, he did not conduct regular church services in his church. Instead, he would visit other groups. In particular, he would go up to a school in Gibbsville, another town located in Sheboygan County, and preached there. And basically, he was waiting for the dispute to die down in his church. And so it was a very difficult time. At one point in time, members of the breakaway group broke into the church building. It was on a Sunday, and Zona was at home. He confronted the three men that were formerly members of his church, and basically threw them out of the church building.
But didn't they? They broke in and started a service. Something of that fact.
It ends up that when they're thrown out, they then go to the justice of the peace and they swear out a complaint against the Reverend Zona, saying that Zona has interfered with a religious service. And that's a violation of the state statute that says to protect the freedom of religion. And so there's even a penal statute that says you're not to interrupt a religious service.
So this is a service. They broke into the church and started the service. And then Zona comes over from his house and gets arrested for breaking up the service. Is that right?
That often happens. The first one to go to the authorities end up being the witnesses for the state.
Three witnesses.
But in any event, what happens is the case actually goes to trial and in front of a jury. Right. And after 2 days, the jury decides that the state has not proven their case. It becomes a hung jury. And basically, they have to decide whether this was manufactured by the three men that broke into the church. And there's even testimony that they really didn't start singing a psalms until
they saw Zonin coming over
to investigate what's going on in his church. There was also testimony that the church was owned by the Presbyterian Church of Holland Township. And the contention by the breakaway group was that he had abandoned the premises, that he wasn't preaching, and so that they had the right as former members to utilize the building.
Really, were you able to find these court records? How did you come across this information?
Well, that actually was something that I uncovered, that that there are court records of the two-day jury trial.
Wow.
And that ended up being an important source for my paper and the description of this two-day trial.
So we should mention this history is significant for the present day, not just for the fact that, you know, many people in our area have a Dutch immigrant background and have ancestors that were involved in this history, but also is significant in our congregations and in our religious life right now. How does Zona's influence have, how did Zona's bringing in this church into the Presbyterian Church come to influence, even the denominations that many of our listeners participate in?
Well, I think really the story of Zona is still useful today, because it points out that church affiliation involves many factors. First and foremost, the doctrine of the denomination that you're considering, the circumstances and availability of really having an active role in that church. And I think that is really a legacy that Zona established. By joining the Presbyterian denomination, after his ministry, other churches would become members of the Presbyterian mm-hmm. denomination. Sometimes it was due to unfortunate situations where members of a congregation would want to call a minister, particularly a Dutch-speaking minister, and perhaps the denomination would not approve that. But for whatever the reason, other Presbyterian churches did emerge following the path of Zona. And so today, there is a Orthodox Presbyterian church in Cedar Grove that traces its roots to the church established by Zona. Hmm. There's an OPC church in Oostburg as well. And there's others within Wisconsin that an argument can be made. They exist but for the fact that Zona made the decision that he did back in 1853.
A Dutch secessionist minister and his and many people that immigrated actually helped. You can make the argument that they allowed for many of the Reformed Presbyterian congregations that arose in Wisconsin.
Well, and actually, I think you've hit an important point. Mm-hmm. In the end, for Zona, it wasn't necessarily that it was a Dutch denomination.
Yeah.
The Presbyterian Church had the same, I mean, it had a Presbyterian form of government.
Sure, sure.
So he knew that that congregation would be able to have control over the ministers that would be called to that church. He wasn't preoccupied with necessarily perpetuating a denomination because it had the word Dutch in its name. I mean, he really looked at the situation in Wisconsin, realized that the immigrants in Wisconsin would have to Americanize much more quickly than the larger Dutch colonies in Western Michigan and Pella, Iowa. And I think that that actually was part of his motivation to join the Presbyterian denomination.
Mm. Now, one thing today, we have close interchurch relations, the OPC, the PCA, the URC, the RPCNA, are many of these churches that would span the divide between Presbyterian and Reformed, but still have close relationships with one another. And so in Zona, we see actually kind of a personal manifestation of that kind of bridging of the gap. We have those good and close brothers that subscribe to the three forms of unity. On the one hand is typically the continental tradition. And then we have the Presbyterian tradition who subscribe often to the Westminster standards. Was that a hang up for Zona, or was that a hang up for others in the mid 19th century?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I think Zona still preached from the three forms of unity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the point has to be made here that these churches are being organized on the frontier mm-hmm. of the Middle West.
Sure.
And in terms of the messages from the pulpit, it really relied upon the minister to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I was able to research, there weren't necessarily significant changes in how the service was conducted when it was an independent Reformed mm-hmm. church to when it became a Presbyterian church.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that Presbyterian churches in general had a greater ministry in the state of Wisconsin and would have ultimately a greater impact
mm-hmm.
statewide And I think that that's something, again, that Zona realized that these Dutch immigrants were now in America. And if you consider the Presbyterian Church in 1853, mm-hmm. I think you might be hard-pressed to say that it was less Orthodox than what the RCA was at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. Now, certainly many things happened, and no doubt there were other events that occurred over the next 70 years in Presbyterianism, even in Wisconsin. But over the next 70 years, the Presbyterian Church eventually found itself in the middle of the modernist fundamentalist debates, mainly up in out east in New York. But that shows that Zona's church and whatever he planted and fed and nurtured went on by God's grace to eventually go into a denomination that's still around. I mean, they left the mainline church and went into the OPC at some point in time through, oddly enough, a new school route. Could the same be said for Van Ralta? What happened over the 70-year difference? And then if we could extend that to 150 years, where is Van Ralta's tradition today? And are there any lessons to be learned comparing that to Zona's history?
Well, you do have to remember that after Van Ralta affiliated with the RCA, mm-hmm. Some of the churches in Classis Holland actually jumped ship, so to speak, as part of, and were part of the organization of the Christian Reformed Church, the CRC. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And basically, part of that argument was that those churches believed that the transition to join the RCA happened too quickly, did not involve enough involvement from the general membership. And perhaps there was concern about the orthodoxy of the eastern area RCA churches, mm-hmm. on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. So right away, orthodoxy was an issue, even for the Dutch immigrants in western Michigan. As far as the Presbyterians in Wisconsin, following the direction of Zona, I think actually it turned out that it was a benefit not to have the ethnic tie to the church. They didn't have to concern themselves. They felt very confident in their religion, that they didn't have to feel the need to stay with a particular denomination because it was, quote-unquote, the Dutch church.
The Dutch church. Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately, I think that that became an opportunity for those Dutch descendants to see, in the case of the PCUSA, some of the churches in Wisconsin, these Dutch immigrant church, originally Dutch immigrant churches, decided that they needed to leave, that they needed to have more orthodoxy. And I believe it was easier for them than perhaps being a member of a Dutch church and having to leave a Dutch church.
Yeah.
And again, you have the opportunity. There are three OPC churches that now exist in Sheboygan County. Mm-hmm. And they're really, one way or another, an outgrowth of Zona's original church.
It's really amazing, especially with the Dutch immigrants, just to see the power of the Reformed community in this sense and how closely they work together and how they have had such an enduring impact even 150 years later. I really appreciate you taking the time to research this subject, Brian, and kind of to pull the thread of history. I think it's a lesson for everybody. You know, there's an OP church in Cedar Grove, Wisconsin, but how many people have, now I know several have, but I mean, how many people would pull that thread and trace it all the way back, even back to Netherlands and the secessionist movement? It's a fascinating subject, and it just goes to show how much is involved in each and every one of our churches to bring them to where they are today. So I want to thank you, Brian, for joining us today. It's been a fascinating discussion.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. Well, we want to point people to our website, reformedforum.org, where you'll be able to find out more information. In the show notes for this episode, we hope to have a number of resources and descriptions that are available for those of you who would like to follow up on this subject and to learn more. We can also put you into contact with Brian if you would like to. And we hope one day that his paper will be published. We're working on some options there and seeing where it might find a home. But we're really excited about this subject, and we know that you are going to be interested in this subject as well. So send us a note at mail@reformedforum.org, or you can tweet us at Reformed Forum. We love hearing from you, and we'll get back to you soon. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time on Christ the Center.